This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. Okay, hello today. We would like to welcome Rachel Su, a PhD student in UBC's Department of Linguistics, to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
Excellent.
Could you maybe start by telling us a bit about yourself and how you got into linguistics?
Yeah, totally. So my name is Rachel Su. I'm a PhD candidate in the Department of Linguistics here at UBC. I moved to Vancouver about 3 years ago. I'm originally from Toronto. I did my undergraduate degree and my master's degree in linguistics and before joining the wonderful group of linguists and language researchers here at UBC. I got involved in linguistics sort of by accident. So originally when I was doing my undergraduate degree, I was specializing in English because I've always sort of been fascinated by languages. And because I had, you know, a slot in my timetable that was available, I decided to take a linguistics course on a whim, thinking that the things that I would learn in that linguistics course would, you know, supplement my English degree. And it turns out that that really wasn't the case. Linguistics ended up being, you know, studying like the skeleton of a language or the structure of a language, which is quite different from what people typically study in English. But I ended up loving it. And I decided then to, you know, jump out of my English degree and straight into linguistics. And ever since I've been doing that.
Excellent. So this is something that, you know, like back when you were like in high school or before that, it's not something you never really like consider, right?
That's right. Yeah. And it was sort of a shame because I think that if I had been introduced to linguistics as a potential field that I could specialize in, I would definitely have jumped into it right away. The only sort of taste of linguistics that students in high school get is through the language courses that they take. And that's, you know, similar to the things that would be involved in a linguistics degree, but not quite the same. So yeah, I feel very lucky to have stumbled upon it because it's really
for great. Those of us who are listening in, you know, as well as like Gurman and I don't think we've taken any linguistics courses before. Have you, Gurman? No,
I have not.
So like, how would you describe this feel, the field of linguistics, you know, as a whole?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. So one way to be thinking about sort of what linguists do on a day-to-day basis is really try to answer the question of like, you know, what does it mean to know a language, right? So do either of you speak languages other than English?
I do.
Nice. Yeah, what other language do you speak?
I speak Farsi, which is like Persian.
Nice. Yeah. So I'm sure that you would both sort of be able to tell, you know, what's a real word of English versus what's a real word of Farsi. And you'd also be able to, you know, tell when a sentence is, you know, wildly ungrammatical. And so linguists, you know, try to tackle these issues, right? Like, what does it mean when you have native speaker knowledge about a particular language? And that sort of endeavor happens at different levels. So there is, you know, researchers who focus on, you know, sound level phenomena. So phoneticians, and that's broadly the area that my research focuses on. But then there are people who also work sort of up from that. So thinking about how those sounds are strung together to produce words. So people who study morphology would be dabbling in that. And then of course, you know, it goes on and on, right? So how are those words then strung into sentences? That'd be the study of syntax. And how do we extract meaning from those sentences? And that would be broadly what people in semantics do. And I mean, I could go on and on because there are ways in which you can sort of join these different theoretical disciplines with more application-based topics, but yeah.
Over the year of our show, we've had researchers from anthropology, science, history, whole bunch of places. How would the research methods in linguistics differ from all the other fields?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So certainly a lot of the work that's done on the experimental side of linguistics borrows from a lot of methods from psychology and cognitive science. So at least in the work that I do in speech perception, which is largely interested in how listeners perceive speech sounds, we borrow a lot of perceptual methods from psychology. But the people who specialize in non-experimental work, so in field work, where linguists are liaising with native speakers of a particular language, those methods largely are in line with the kinds of things that people do in anthropology and perhaps also other disciplines.
Great. Could you maybe tell us a bit about some of the research you do in the Speech and Context Lab?
So I am very proud to be a member of the Speech and Context Lab. We have an amazing group of students, of faculty, of language researchers, of linguists in general. And the work that I do in the Speech and Context Lab largely centers around speech perception, as I said earlier. So how people, you know, extract speech sounds out of an utterance. And I also focus on how bilinguals in particular accomplish this task of speech perception. And it's a really, really fantastic place to be doing that kind of research in UBC, or I guess in Vancouver in general, because of how linguistically diverse the city is.
Yeah, how would the sort of linguistic differences in English differ from like Vancouver to like a totally different multicultural city like London or LA?
Yeah, so that's reminds me of a paper that I was reading in my lab a couple of weeks ago, where we were really calling into question, you know, like, what does it mean to be a native speaker of a particular language? And the answer there is it really depends on how you want to be defining a native speaker, right? So the sort of English that we speak in Vancouver is going to bear particular acoustic features that aren't going to be present in the English that's spoken in, you know, parts of America. And so what people who research speech perception are interested in is, yeah, how do people differentiate the specific dialects of English that they speak? And another kind of really big prong, I'll say, in the Speech and Context Lab is how people extract social meaning out of those really minute acoustic signatures from specific English dialects.
Now, when speaking about English dialects, you know, of course, I would know if someone is speaking English in, say, the typical like Canadian accent, it would be distinguishable from, say, the Australian accent. But for more like smaller differences, would an untrained person be able to identify or any differences, or would you have to be like trained in specific methods or use like specialized equipment to be able to discern these differences in speech?
So I'll get back to a point that you made earlier about a Canadian accent, because I mean that itself is like really hard to identify, right? Like the people who speak English in, I don't know, Vancouver are going to be really different from are going to sound really different rather than the people who speak English in Nova Scotia, but both of those people are considered Canadian, right? So it's just really fascinating to me that there is such a range of, you know, pronunciation differences, despite the fact that we all sort of live in the North. Mm-hmm. But to get to your point about, you know, what kinds of things you need to be able to detect dialect differences, I mean, people are really good at identifying accents. So sort of at base, at minimum, all you really need is a keen ear to be hearing particular differences in, you know, vowel pronunciations or in intonation changes across the sentence or in, you know, consonant pronunciation differences. But for more fine grained differences, that sort of takes a more complex set of equipment. So both in the form of hardware, So good set of recorders, good set of microphones, as well as software that we use.
And how, you know, minute would these differences be? For example, would it be possible to notice like difference in patterns of speech from like people living in different parts of Vancouver or even like different parts of British Columbia, for example?
Yeah, totally. That reminds me of a study that I think is currently still being conducted in the Speech and Context Lab, which if folks are interested, could totally visit our website and take part in it. It's basically an experiment that's aimed at just sampling the rich linguistic, you know, landscape that's present in British Columbia. So people can, you know, list sort of where they were born and bred in British Columbia, and then produce a span of speech. And then we'd ultimately sort of take a look at that and sort of see what is there for us to index these differences. So I suspect that there are differences in how people speak in different parts of British Columbia. And I don't have the results from that study. I think the data collection is ongoing, but I'd be curious to see what they find.
That's pretty cool.
We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message, so please stay tuned.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theatre, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theatre, visit their website at www.riotheatre.ca.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is Research Review, and today we are interviewing Rachel Hsu, a PhD candidate in UBC's Department of Linguistics. So far, we've talked a bit about what the field of linguistics is and also a bit about how language patterns can differ by region. And, you know, I see that, you know, you've done a bit of research on these so-called heritage speakers. So what are heritage speakers and what makes them unique?
Yeah, so I think there are probably a lot of people growing up in Canada who are heritage speakers that don't know it. So really broadly speaking, heritage speakers are bilinguals. These heritage speakers often, but don't have to, come from immigrant families. So learning language at home, they learn the quote unquote heritage language of their parents. For me, I'm a heritage speaker, it was Cantonese. For others, it might've been Farsi. For others, it might've been Mandarin, Japanese, whatever it may be. As these children sort of mature in a society where the dominant language is not the language that they learned at home. So for instance, a heritage speaker growing up in Canada, the dominant language there would be English. They ultimately sort of have to do this flip in which they have to start learning a language that is not the same as the language that they've been learning at home. And so their first language is the language that they learn at home. Their second language is the language of the dominant society. And then they ultimately become more fluent in that second language. And what's unique about heritage speakers is that this sort of acquisition profile in which they are more dominant in their second language is really quite different from sort of traditional conceptualizations of second language speakers. So I think people typically think of second language speakers as, you know, people who learn a language, perhaps French in school, well past the quote unquote sensitive period for learning language. And of course, they're not as fluent in that second language. So heritage speakers are really interesting because they represent a group of bilinguals who are more fluent in the second language, which is sort of in contrast to traditional conceptualizations of the bilingual.
Now, you know, if a study were to be done, you know, for on, say, like individuals like you or myself, you know, who are these heritage speakers, when we were speaking English, would it be possible to identify the fact that, you know, we speak another language natively?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So heritage speakers are typically described as being, so dominant in their second language. So I don't think that it'd be possible. I mean, I'm sure people have taken a look at this, but my hunch is that you wouldn't be able to detect that they speak another language because they are so fluent in that second language, in this case, English, or in the Canadian context, mostly English. But studies have been done, mostly taking a look at how heritage speakers sort of maintain their first language, which of course is the language that they learned at home, but are now less fluent in because they've had to sort of make a trade-off between that first language and that second language. And in those studies where you focus on the heritage speaker's first language rather than their second language, you do see differences emerge between a heritage speaker and perhaps just a monolingual speaker of that first language.
Mm-hmm. And you've done a lot of research, I believe, on Cantonese and English. Like, what are some of the key findings that you've noticed?
Yeah, so Cantonese is a tone language, which means that it uses pitch fluctuations on words to contrast linguistic meanings. So this isn't the case in English, right? So if I say puppy in a very low voice or puppy in a very high voice, you still get the sense that it's the word puppy. But that's not necessarily the case in Cantonese. So,
and most other languages are not tone languages, or are there any other like prominent tonal?
Yeah. So there are, I think the most prominent tone language, or at least the tone language that people have done the most research on is Mandarin, which is another Chinese dialect. But there are certainly also other languages that make use of tone. So Punjabi is another language. Vietnamese is another language. A number of Niger-Congo languages also utilize tone to some extent. So there are many more than the ones that I've listed. So
interesting.
Probably more than we think. Yeah. So I was saying the case in Cantonese is if the sequence of consonants and vowels puppy was available in Cantonese, you could say that set a high pitch or a low pitch, and that would mean convey differences in linguistic meaning. So the key findings in sort of the bilingual / heritage speaker work that I've done on Cantonese is that heritage speakers are surprisingly really good at maintaining tone in their first language, Cantonese, despite the fact that they're, again, more fluent in English, where tone is not used. And I think that speaks to, a broader question about what it means to be bilingual. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you're better in one language than another. It means that you have varying linguistic ability in each of those languages.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Could you maybe tell us a bit about the spice corpus and what is a corpus?
Yeah, really great question. And I'm super happy that you asked that question because one of my good friends, Kia Johnson, is the person who really brought this to fruition. The spice corpus stands for speech in Cantonese and English, and it contains basically speech files from Cantonese and English bilinguals in both languages. So the way in which we collected this data or for the corpus, which is just sort of like a collection of speech, be that spoken speech or text speech, in this case, it's spoken speech. We had, or I should say Kia had a bunch of Cantonese English bilinguals come into the lab and then do a number of tasks. So those tasks included just reading sentences in Cantonese and English. I think there was also a storyboard narration aspect to the spice corpus, and then a sociolinguistic interview where the Cantonese English bilinguals were just having a chat with other people in both languages.
Yeah, so what kind of findings came out of the spice corpus?
So it has, I think, only just recently been released. So a lot of the studies that have been using the spice corpus are still sort of in the process of like data collection. But I'll say what's really great about the spice corpus is that a lot of the corpora that exist in linguistics really focus on monolingual speech. And so this is a really unique corpus in that we have speech from these bilinguals in both languages, making the kinds of research questions that require sort of within speaker comparisons really appropriate for this PICE corpus.
Great. I guess I may or may not be a heritage speaker. When I grew up, like growing up, I knew Punjabi until like the age of like 5-ish. And then like I totally forgot it once English came into the picture. So right. How would that make me different from like a different heritage speaker, or would I qualify as a heritage speaker at that point?
Yeah. So I think you would definitely qualify as a heritage speaker. There are sort of different descriptions of a heritage speaker. The sort of broad definition of a heritage speaker is someone who just identifies with the culture associated with a particular language. And the more narrow definition of a heritage speaker is someone who grows up in their home before they're exposed to or before they mature in the dominant society. With a different language, so whatever the language of your parents or caretakers might have been, and then ultimately transition to becoming more fluent, and indeed in this case so fluent that the first language has sort of fallen to the wayside in the dominant language. So yeah, I think you would definitely be considered a heritage speaker. And this brings up a point that is echoed a lot in the heritage speaker research, which is sort of this notion of language attrition, which means loss of language. And I hesitate to sort of describe it as that because it has sort of pejorative connotations, to sort of lose a language, or to sort of pitch heritage speakers in such a way that they are, you know, lacking something. So while it is sometimes the case that heritage speakers are ultimately super duper fluent in that second language, there are also, of course, some heritage speakers who, maintain some amount of fluency in that first language.
Interesting. And, you know, just one question I have, because a few years ago when I was browsing UBC's undergraduate course catalog, I noticed that for some language courses, I think it was specifically like Mandarin, there were separate classes for heritage and non-heritage speakers offered who wanted to like learn the language. Whereas for other languages, you know, say, for example, like Italian, there was no such distinction made. So is there a reason where for certain languages, when it, like education or instruction is being done, there is like this separation between the two categories?
Yeah, so I think that that really speaks to sort of an acknowledgement of the fact that heritage speakers are in some cases really great at their first language, despite the fact that they're more fluent in that second language. And so perhaps incorporating sort of like a differentiation between courses is one way to make clear that heritage speakers know this language. And so perhaps a language course that dives into really basic concepts of a particular language or basic aspects of a language wouldn't be super appropriate for them because they have some amount of native speaker knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
We'll be right back here on Research Review after one short message.
Do you like that? How about that? Mondays, 5 p.m. Deliberate Noise. Nina Panini, special guest Claire. Local, new, hot, upcoming shows, toilets, friendship. Mondays at 5. CITR. Be there. Be there.
1, 2.
Be there.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Alarad, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we are interviewing Rachel Su, a PhD candidate in UBC's Department of Linguistics.
Just one random question now, just out of curiosity. Yeah. Other than English and Cantonese, since you've worked with those two languages a lot, what is your favorite language?
Oh, I can't choose. Linguists always sort of say, like, there is no one language that is better than another language.
Not like in terms of being better, but I would ask like two questions. Yeah. What is the one that you find most interesting, and what is the one that you, if you could become fluent in this language overnight, you would choose that?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I feel like I'm having to pick my favorite child or something here. The language that I do a lot of research in is Cantonese, partly because I speak Cantonese, and also because I think that it's a super interesting tone language. So sort of what differentiates Cantonese from perhaps other tone languages is the fact that the tone system is super complex. So whereas languages like Mandarin only have four tones, and languages or other languages perhaps only have two tones, Cantonese has six tones. And so it's really quite a feat for heritage speakers to be maintaining, you know, six tones in this language that they're not using on a daily basis, or they're only using with a small set of people. So I'll pick Cantonese because it aligns with what I'm doing right now, research-wise. And if I could pick a language to be fluent in overnight, some of the work that I've done in previous years is on an indigenous language called Gitxsan. And so I would pick that language to be fluent in overnight because it is a super, super cool indigenous, I should say, a super, super cool language, period. The sort of phonotactic structure of that particular language, by which I mean sort of the syllable structures and the kinds of sounds that the language can string together, is really, really fascinating. I've worked with indigenous elders on that language. So if I was able to become fluent in that language overnight, that would not only really help my research, it would just be, you know, super cool.
Now, you know, on the topic of like different languages, like learning languages, have you done any research on how people like specifically like learn or pick up a language?
Yeah, so I haven't, because a lot of the work that I do in speech perception has used, or I guess I should say recruited speakers who already have some amount of native speaker knowledge in the languages at hand. So I haven't done any research on that per se, but there are a number of people in the department who do look at sort of learning of a language in sort of from ground zero. So people who speak a totally different language and then are put through sort of rigorous perceptual training to learn contrasts of a different language. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm just going through some of the research you've done in the past. One of them is called Lexical Bias in Second Language Perception, Word Position, Age of Arrival, and Native Language Phonology. So what is that about?
I did that project so long ago. Let me refresh my memory. Okay.
It was published in 2020.
Oh, that's right. It was. God, time is a flat circle during COVID times. Okay. What did we do in that study? So, right. That study looked at native Mandarin speakers and their perception of sounds that we hear in a word like seashell. So the s sound at the beginning of that word, and then the sh sound in the shell part of that word. And we were interested in looking at that specifically from the perspective of how do these listeners perceive those two sounds in the context of, you know, the lexical knowledge that they have in their arsenal. So Mandarin has a different sort of sound system than English, with, I think, sa and sha both being present in English and Mandarin, but only one of those phonemes being present at particular word positions in Mandarin. So we were interested in how does the word position of these particular sounds affect their Mandarin speakers' perception of those sounds? And can they use the knowledge that they have about the words overall to make those distinctions? So to give you an example, we showed, or rather played Mandarin listeners words like shampooing and sampooing. And so the idea there would be, it would be really easy for a speaker of English to identify that that initial sound is likely going to be a sh sound because shampooing sampling is not. And so, yeah, that project really tackled the intersection of native speaker phonology and lexical knowledge, or just, you know, word knowledge.
And I would assume that, you know, there are some sounds in different languages that, you know, would not exist in a certain language. So is that is true? Yes.
Yeah, totally. Basically, totally.
Because, you know, like I've noticed that as well. And how would that influence when people are, for example, like learning a second language or acquiring other languages?
Yeah, so there's a lot of research sort of on the second language acquisition front that takes a look at what speakers do when they have a phoneme or a sound in one language that's simply absent from their other language, or perhaps not absent, but really similar to another sound. And a lot of the work that's been done there has shown that listeners basically assimilate a new sound to a sound that's more similar in their native language. So that's done in a number of ways, right? So there are a lot of really fine-grained acoustic differences across sounds, and listeners can be picking different sort of acoustic signatures up to be making those assimilations.
Interesting.
You are listening to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. We'll be right back after a short message.
It's time to unlock the bathroom door and talk about Crohn's and colitis. They're lifelong diseases. They're on the rise among children under 10. And they involve severe abdominal pain, chronic diarrhea, and for many people, life-altering surgery. They're mired in secrecy and embarrassment, ignorance and fear, which only adds to the pain. It's time to make it stop. Crohn's and colitis. Make it stop for life. Visit crohnsandcolitis.ca.
We are back here on Research Review. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. So, you have any thoughts, Garmon?
Yeah, I had one question that came up while you were talking. I know there are lots of different accents or phonetic variations in English, for example, but how would that work for nonverbal languages, like a sign language, for example?
Yeah, there is a really fantastic group of linguists in the department who are doing sign language research. So if anybody's interested, I would really recommend sort of visiting the website and perusing those, because contrary to what some people might think, sign languages are natural languages. And one way to be thinking about that is from sort of like a quote unquote sound level perspective. Of course, sound is absent in nonverbal languages, but it is sort of present if you consider the fact that in the spoken modality, you can swap one sound out and put another one in a particular word, and that'll make meaning differences. And that's what we call minimal pairs in linguistics. So for instance, I can put, I can say the word, cat, and I can take that initial k sound out and then put perhaps a p sound in, pat. And both of those are real words of English. And so in the same way that minimal differences in words translate to differences in linguistic meaning, you find that same parallel in sign languages, where, you know, just a change in the flexion of a particular finger will give you a different word. And so, you know, to sort of make the parallel there, this might be P. I am, for those who can't see me, sticking my index finger straight up and flexed. And this, where I bend my finger, would be K. And those minimal differences translate to differences in linguistic meaning. Mm-hmm.
Let's see. One last question. Your PI, this is like a random question that just came up while Ali and I were talking before the interview.
Yeah.
Your PI's name is Molly Babel, and I found that to be the most appropriate name for a linguistics researcher.
So I it's really funny that you say that, because I also thought that her last name was Babel, but it's actually pronounced Babel, kind of like label.
Oh.
And so wouldn't it be super appropriate though if her last name was Babel, given that she does this amazing speech research? Molly's great. I can't, sing her praises enough. She's a fantastic PI.
On that topic of Babel and Babel, this is my last question before we wrap things up.
Sure.
But I don't know if you've done like a lot of research on like alphabets and the way things are written, but why is it in English compared to other languages? Most of the time things do not sound the way they're written at all.
Yeah. Really, really good observation there. And the example that linguists love to give to sort of show that is sort of asking people to pronounce the sequence of letters G-H-O-T-I. A lot of people would read that as, you know, goatee, gaudy, go-tie. And there are a number of different ways that you can pronounce that. But in the same way that people might pronounce that sequence of letters as, you know, gaudy, goatee, whatever you might want to pronounce it as, you can also pronounce it as fish, which is totally not transparent, right? So the GH portion comes from the th sound that you hear in a word like enough, where that word ends in a GH sequence. The O sound, the O symbol, which translates to an I sound, is the same sound that you hear in a word like women. And then the TI sequence of letters that you hear as sh is the same sound that you hear in words like nation or emotion. Mm-hmm. And so this is really to highlight the point that you made earlier about how non-transparent, or rather non-linear, I guess you could say, the English orthographic system is when it comes to speech sounds. So why that is the case is probably some combination of just historical consequences on the English orthographic system. But acknowledging that that is, you know, such a conundrum in speech research, most of the time we don't use the English alphabet to do research, because one, that would be super English centric, and of course we do research on a number of other languages, and two, because it's just not very feasible. So we use something called the International Phonetic Alphabet, where there are particular symbols that correspond in a one-to-one relationship with a particular sound.
Now, what is one language or like, you know, alphabet system that, unlike English, it's very like phonetically correct in a way?
So there are, a ton of different orthographic systems that exist. I don't do much research on orthographic systems, because most of the research that I do is on spoken language, so focusing sort of on the auditory modality. And orthographic research really places the emphasis on sort of the visual modality. So how do people sort of see what's on the screen and then process that?
Interesting. Because there was just one last thing to add, because I know are you familiar with the Turkish language?
Yes.
Because, you know, around a century ago, the script for that language was like basically Latinized. Right. So in a way, it's relatively new. And as far as I know, like the way things are read, it's basically like the way you see it is the way it's read. There's unlike English, there is no like ambiguities or situations where like something might appear one way and then in reality, it's like pronounced differently. So I guess that might also have to do with like the age of like certain languages or certain scripts. It's like,
So I think to go back to my point about there being a lot of historical and in some cases political sort of baggage associated with language, both in its spoken form and in its orthographic form, you definitely sort of see the remnants of that in orthographic systems. And there are some orthographic systems that are sort of a little bit more straightforward, I'll say, in terms of its mapping between the symbol and the sound. Than you know, English, where, as we've seen with the example that I mentioned earlier, it's not that straightforward. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Excellent. So, Gurman, you have anything else to add?
No, that's about it for me.
It's nice. Yeah. Well, thank you for joining us on Research Review today. It was a very lively and nice conversation we had.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys.
This concludes Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. And that was our interview with Rachel Su, a PhD candidate in UBC's Department of Linguistics. We hope you tune back in 2 weeks.